Welcome back. We are pleased to be with Tony Horowitz, Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon. Myth. Wow, Bill. But that also is where you end up.
And it's all through it.
You track the myth from the beginning. You track it in kind of comic book fashion that in a complimentary way, about Plymouth Rock,
right.
What did we all get taught in history, right. Which
but
was pretty much comic book.
It's also the myths that the Spanish were dealing with, the French, the English. Right. They all had this, this worldview
and
that was predicated on a set of shared stories,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which is basically a lot of what these myths mm-hmm. are, but they lead right. to perceptions.
Right.
So having set the predicates.
Yeah, well, just first on Slotkin's point, I mean, one thing that's very striking about this era is certainly the violence and the race. A lot of what becomes the American story has its roots in this era before the English even show up, or certainly before Plymouth. Obviously, the violence against natives all through this era, but African slavery begins, very early in Hispaniola in the early 1500s with Columbus. And then it begins in Jamestown in 1619. So even before Plymouth is founded, you've got the roots of a lot of the American story. So I think it's important to recognize where, there are a lot of roots feeding this tree, whatever, that became our history. As to a new myth emerging, I don't know. I would like to think we could live without those myths, and we can have still shared values and a shared history. But does that need to become a new myth? I don't know.
Part of this is myth is one of those really ambiguous words.
Yeah.
I really think of it in the terms that Joseph Campbell uses,
yeah.
which is the unifying story.
Right.
Stories that we share, that we tell one another, mm-hmm. that essentially establishes, in some ways, the downside, us as opposed to somebody else, the other.
Right.
But it ultimately is a way of defining the community, and
right.
we are just such quintessentially social creatures.
Sure.
Well,
and
Campbell's premise is that myth needs to be grounded in the globe rather than in the tribe. I mean, he gets there at the end of his life. Mm-hmm. That myth could include what you opened to me, and I'd completely forgotten, the 500 years that comes before
right.
Columbus.
We've
got 1,000 years
yeah.
of Europeans
right.
on our continent.
Yeah, we think of one of the myths we have is that we're a young country, we're the new world. Well, we're a lot older than we think, and that's speaking only for the European history. Right. Obviously, the native history goes back 12,000 years or more.
And so we forget that, too. The natives are newcomers
exactly.
as well.
So, I think we have to kind of tear down the old myth before we can get started building a new one. I think the real wild card in the equation is the changing demographics of this country.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that I think Confederate remembrance will never go away, but I have to believe it's going to diminish over time as less and less people in the South are from the South. As the South looks more and more like the rest of the nation, and as more and more Hispanics and Asians and others come here, that Confederate story, I have to believe, is going to have less resonance. In the same way, if you imagine current trends 50 years down the road, will the English story and Plymouth have the same hold on people in 2050 when, a much higher percentage are of non-English extraction? I don't know.
Cornel West has, now that I think about it, it's not a myth so much as is his set of predicates, which he takes back to the Greek tradition, the Jewish tradition, and the African-American tradition. He speaks of the Greek tradition of dialogue. And as being very, 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 very important, which particularly in a country that for which democracy is very central would seem to be important. He also talks of the importance of the Jewish insistence on justice,
mm-hmm.
also a fairly palatable concept. And then he adds in the African American tradition, which is very central, as you say. It's all through American
mm-hmm.
history. From day two, assuming right. the first people were day one, which he characterizes as tragicomic hope, which is in a way it goes to what I think you're looking at,
right.
which is let's can't we find if we got to have these stories,
right?
Can't we make them a little more interesting, you know, update them, resynthesize. And I think as much as anything, he's arguing for that resynthesis that, mm-hmm. that, and to extract from the resources we have, which certainly are the black experience.
Right.
And he looks at jazz and a lot of other things. But it also increasingly includes that Hispanic inputs lots of others.
I think it's a good point, because as dark as this era is that I'm writing about, it's incredibly rich culturally. In a sense, you know, early America looked a little like America today. You mm-hmm. have this very mm-hmm. diverse, fluid society, almost a kind of international food fight mm-hmm. with Spanish, French, Portuguese. You've got African Americans here, very early natives, of course, Moors, some Jews. You've got a real, I wouldn't call it a melting pot.
Germans and Poles and all those Vikings.
It certainly wasn't a melting pot, but it was an interesting cultural stew, and I think recapturing that as part of our national identity, which we talk about in relation to immigration, but when we talk about our early history, it's always this kind of Anglo thing, and then everything that happens later is in opposition to that. It's immigrants coming to an Anglo land. Well, I think we can flip that around and say it was really Anglos who came to what was already a largely Hispanic continent, but an international place.
Well, and particularly, we also ignore the French.
Completely.
I mean, you know, we were bracketed by the French and the Spanish.
Yeah, exactly.
The English settlers.
English colonies,
I also think of that story that I don't think I'd heard before of the, I think it was up, it was near the time of the Pilgrims, when one of the English people exploring New England, what is now New England, came across a boatload of locals, you know, one of whom was wearing a top hat or something.
Oh, tell us that story.
Yeah, it's Bartholomew Gosnold, and he's the first Englishman known to have led an expedition to what's now New England. There may have been earlier ones, but he's the first we know about. They're looking for sassafras, which was believed to be a cure for syphilis, so they weren't coming for religious freedom. And they arrive first off the coast of Maine, and the first people they see are these curious characters in what looks like a European boat wearing European clothes, and they turn out to be Indians who have had contact for decades with Basque fishermen. And they speak a few words of different languages. And one of the Englishmen writes, you know, they seem to sort of know much more about us than we knew about them. And again, to me, it was just an example of the English being latecomers, that here they were thinking we're arriving at this unknown shore. Well, it wasn't unknown to many other European peoples, and there had been quite a bit of interaction already.
This is a really important story when you get this really narrow-minded, bigoted, I would say, mm-hmm. immigration argument mm-hmm. that somehow we have to protect a white Anglo-Christian state,
right.
almost a WASP state, and
right.
it's just factually inaccurate.
Yeah, I think, you know, however you feel about that debate, let's ground it in the actual history, which was that this was a largely Hispanic continent before the first Anglos ever got here. That doesn't give any one group, you know, the ultimate right to it, but to sort of cast this as an Anglo nation, it isn't now, but you know what? It wasn't at the start of our European history either. It was a lot more complicated.
I have a bumper sticker that a friend gave us some time ago that has a group of, I think they're Apache, and the wording on it is fighting terrorism since 1492.
Yeah.
Just to put things in
also Homeland Security also with some pretty tough looking Apache. There's all of that. And there's also people have joked about going over and sort of claiming, discovering Spain, some Indians. I mean, the whole notion of discovery, obviously, and of claiming territory as they did back then is a kind of peculiar notion when you think about it.
Parochialism just seems to be written into the gene pool, doesn't it?
I mean, and sadly, kind of fear of the other. I found it very interesting, the scene in which the Vikings encounter natives of Eastern Canada for the first time, and this is two branches of humanity that have been separated for tens of thousands of years, and they don't even explain why, but as soon as they meet them, they kill them. And they describe them as skraelings, is the Norse word, which means sort of ugly, screeching wretches. That their first reaction to this otherness is kind of, you know, they're strange and they're ugly and we have to kill them. And that didn't happen in all cases, but it is kind of a sad comment on how humans often confront, you know, the other.
And you are very good about turning that around every time you have a chance. Mm-hmm. With a yes, and it didn't have to be that way. The opportunity for it to be other mm-hmm. is there, and occasionally somebody will shine a light
through
for you.
And, you know, it was a relief to me when I found those stories, because, as you said earlier, it would be too unrelenting to only tell the grim side of this story. And the ones who do show humanity, who are often Spanish, which I like, because, again, it upsets our stereotype of the Spanish as all kind of, you know, butchers and inquisitors. In fact, there were many Spaniards of conscience, and some of them really did try and reach across the canyon of language and culture, and they didn't succeed in the end. But you know, no.
Well,
two stories,
it could have been worse.
Yeah.
if you would, I really like the story of the woman, and it's interesting to see women's stories peeking out where you can find them. The one woman who is a native, who is the connector between the Spanish coming up one way and the Spanish coming another way, and there's one lone woman.
Yeah. It's an incredible story, as briefly as I can tell it. Coronado leads an enormous Spanish expedition up from Mexico in the 1540s, and at roughly the same time, De Soto is coming across from Florida with his own army, and Coronado's men capture an Indian woman, and then she escapes, and this happens in Texas. She's running across Texas to escape to her homeland, and she runs into De Soto's men, who have come the other way across the continent, and is captured by them. And these two armies never intersect. As far as I can tell, they didn't really even know the other was there, but this unfortunate Indian woman, about whom sadly we know almost nothing about, except that she's referred to in both accounts, and the De Soto
as tattooed,
men,
as I remember.
A tattooed Indian woman, and as De Soto's men say, remarkably, she was giving the names of these Spanish captains in this other army, and that she was this connecting link between the two greatest expeditions of this era. So
this reminds me of a story that colleagues in Montana told us, I think Blackfeet, about that there was a tradition that there was at least one person in every village who had seen both coasts.
Both the Atlantic and the Pacific on foot.
Well, that's all they had.
Yeah.
And it deals with this parochialism. We think of, you know, these villages as very constrained, without contact.
Right.
And you talk about the trade back and forth.
Exactly.
But that was, and the trails were there.
Yep. These explorers, also another myth, I think, is, you know, they were blazing trails through the wilderness. I don't really know if that was true with Daniel Boone and the others. I doubt it. Certainly in this era, they were following established Indian trails.
If it was, they were stupid.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, let's see. There's a road over here, or you can take your axe and go this way.
Right, exactly.
What you going to do?
We're not going to be stupid, but we are going to go away for just a moment. We'll be right back with Tony Horowitz.